Well, greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on the professionals when we come back. You know, those who already walk submissively will say that there is no cause for alarm, but submissiveness is not our heritage. The First Amendment was designed to allow rebellion to remain as our heritage, and our Constitution was designed to keep government off the backs of the people. Our Bill of Rights was added to keep the precincts of belief and expression of the press, of political and social activities, free from government surveillance. You know, I wished I'd have thought of that statement, but that quotation comes from our Supreme Court. It came from Supreme Court Justice William O. Douglas. Now, you know, our princes, our politicians beller in the halls of Congress for more taxes, more spending, and more gun control, but you and I haven't heard anything intelligent come out of a politician's mouth in more than 75 years. And that's why I contend that the only real reason, logic, or common sense left in America comes from our courts. It doesn't come from the political process. It certainly doesn't come from our politicians, our lawyers, or our bureaucrats. Old Mayor Rothschild summed it up with a flair when he said, "You give me the money power, and I care not who makes the laws." Well, I could echo that by saying, "You give me the judicial power, and I care not who makes the laws either," because the real power in America is in our courts, not in our politics. Now, if you'd like to tap into this power of the courts, why don't you call us here at the law school? The number is 417-273-4967, and be sure to ask for a free general law CD package. It's a four-hour commentary on the law school. It's entertaining, it's educational, and it's informative. Best of all, it's free. That number again, 417-273-4967. Now, our school, Basic Courtroom Strategy and Procedure, is available on compact disc for adult home education. If you're online, go to the website georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email and send us an email request for that free general law CD package. Again, georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, last time we were talking about the harmony of science and scripture, and where we left off, we were talking about logic. Logic. Reason, logic, and common sense. It's my contention that the professionals, the status that all of us seek to attain, we would all like to be PhDs, wouldn't we? Or maybe we would have a master's degree or at least a bachelor's degree. I was encouraged as a youngster to go to college. I didn't, and I'm glad I didn't, but everybody else that I knew wanted to go to college, and many of them did go to college, and they struggled through college. They got their degrees. Many of them have become very successful, and they make a lot of money. And we're encouraged to follow these professionals, and that's my point, that we're encouraged to follow the doctor's orders, the same doctors that have promised us a cure to cancer for the last 100 years, while the cancer rate has gone from 1 in 33 to 1 in 2. These same doctors and scientists and medicos who have promised us cures for every disease that money or time or effort or energy can possibly research and can possibly find a cure to. I mean, they want to cure every disease. But they tell you very plainly, we don't know what causes these diseases and we don't know what the cures are, but if you keep sending us money and marching on polio or marching on cancer or marching on this or that, we'll eradicate it. We'll find a cure for it. We'll do something to solve that problem. We're still waiting. Now, an interesting contention was brought up here by Harry Rimmer. He's the scientist, remember? This is Dr. Harry Rimmer, PhD, scientist, 1936. And he came to the same conclusion, that there's no conflict between the Bible and science. There's a big conflict between science and religion. Big conflict. We all know about the stories of the Catholic Church back in the Middle Ages making great pronouncements that the world was flat and that the sun revolved around the earth and so on, which then later we found out scientifically that that's not true. But the Bible told us that the world was round three times in the scriptures. I don't know why the popes and the Catholics came to the conclusion that it was flat. I suppose it was for the same reason that they came to the conclusion that Jesus was born on December 25th, which everybody knows he wasn't, but then we follow tradition. And then, of course, scientific people or people that can still think have rejected religion, probably with good cause. But they've also rejected the Bible without good cause because the Bible didn't agree with the religionists to start with. And Harry Rimmer brought that out. And so the last time he mentioned that only the thoughtless and those who are utterly lacking in logic can reply that chance is the combiner of the factors of creation, speaking of the 96 elements. The statement that life began with a fortuitous combination of accidental circumstances and then started a process of development and gradual change is not acceptable to any thinking and reasoning creature. Since the factors of the physical structure are known, and since we recognize the fact that they cannot be manipulated without intelligence into the mathematical formula and combinations of geometric intricacy, chance is totally ruled out. Now, we might as well say that success in solving mathematical problems depends upon luck. How many times would it be necessary, let us say, to cast the 10 factors, 0 through 9, the factors of mathematics from a dice box onto a table before accident arranged these little symbols into the proper answer to a problem in higher mathematics? The solution of a problem in calculus would not be arrived at in 100 million years of incessant casting forth of the 10 factors of that problem if the entire matter were left merely to chance. Can chance solve an equation? Can chance add a simple column of figures? Can chance multiply 7 figures by 6 figures and then find the right solution? If mathematics depended upon luck or accident, we're very sure that many of us would have had better marks in this fascinating subject of mathematics in the days of our student experiences. Whatever else our conclusion may be concerning the origin of matter, we may well rule out the theory of chance. Now, I'm going to pause here for a moment, and I'm going to make my own editorial comment here. Rimmer, in the last program, if you'll remember, pointed out that there are 96 elements, and that these 96 elements are the basic building blocks of everything that we see around us. For instance, we look at water, and we see that that's hydrogen and oxygen. It's a combination of two elements out of 96. Then we come along, and we take a look at salt, and we say, well, we've got sodium and chloride, and we put those two elements together, and we come up with salt. Everything in the physical universe comes from these 96 elements. Now let's take it a step further. We've been told by the intelligentsia, that is, the paid professionals, that's the people with the PhDs, the astronomers, the mathematicians, the teachers and the college professors, that there was a Big Bang. Remember the Big Bang? And that there was this great big atom. It may have been a real small atom. I don't know how big this atom was, but this is just one. All the mass and matter in the world were all condensed into this one ball, and it exploded. And what we see today is the results of that explosion. Now, that's what we've been told, isn't it? Isn't that what you read in your Sunday papers? Isn't that what you read and heard and were taught when you went to college and high school? Now, Rimmer pointed out here that all of this mass and matter over here is running down, and it's called entropy, the two fundamental laws of thermodynamics, and that is that there has been no past eternity of matter. Now, I was first taught that law, that principle, in the ninth grade by Mr. Turner in Eureka High School in about 1955. I'm an old man now, but I've known for most of my life, at least from about age, 14 or 15, that mass and matter have not always existed. And that mass and matter are running down. They're going out of existence, and that there's no mass and matter that's ever been observed by anybody coming into existence. And you want to know something, boys and girls? There isn't a scientist in America. There's not a nuclear physicist. There's not a mathematician. There isn't anybody with a PhD, a master's. There isn't anybody with a crummy bachelor's degree that doesn't know that. Now, there might be a few of us plumbers, carpenters, electricians, and bottle washers and wetback swimming across the river that maybe hadn't heard that, but now you know. Us common folk down here, we at least have an excuse. We didn't go to college, but every one of these people that went to college know that basic truth. And anybody that spouts off about evolution is either a liar, or he knew or should have known better. As old Mark Twain used to say, you got liars, you got damn liars, and then you got statisticians. And I think we're dealing with a lot of damn liars. Now, any of you listening to me right now know as well as I do about these two basic laws of thermodynamics. Matter has not always existed. And that was Rimmer's point, that if matter hasn't always existed, then somebody had to have created it. Now, there happens to be a guy here in the scripture that says, hey, listen, he raises his hand and he says, hey, listen, let me tell you what happened here. Sometime back, during about 6 days of time, I created all this mass and matter. In fact, I did it in about 24 hours. Now, the last time I saw anything about this Hubble telescope, talking about the size and scope of this mass and matter, compared to us, now I'm about 6 foot tall, see. And then I stand here on planet Earth. Now, this planet Earth has about 6 billion of us guys walking around on the planet here. And this planet is just one of 9 that circles the sun. We call that a solar system. And then that solar system is just one of 350 million solar systems in one galaxy called the Milky Way. Now, we find, after about 100 years of study, that there are approximately 2 trillion of these galaxies like the Milky Way. And that's in the first 12 billion light years that we can see out. Somebody said the other day they're going to build a new Hubble telescope, and they're going to look out 25 billion years. I'm not a prophet, but I think that what they're going to find is more of the same. I think they're trying to look into God's bedroom window is what they've got in mind over here, but it's further out than 25 billion light years. Now, that means that if there's 2 trillion in the first 12 billion light years, there's probably about another 2 or 3 or 5 trillion the further out you go. Now, let's stop and think about that. That's a big piece of real estate. And this guy in the scripture says, I made all of that in about 24 hours. And that boggles everybody's mind. I mean, you know, stop and think about that. That's a fur piece out there. And that's a lot of real estate, especially to all be created in 24 hours. Now, I wasn't there, and I cannot tell you that, yes, he did that, or no, he did not do that. And most of these smart people, the people with degrees after their names, they don't believe that. But let me ask you this. When was the last time that somebody's disbelief proved the truth? You know, just because I don't believe it, does that mean that it's not true? I mean, if I came to you and I said, I don't believe that there is a weapon, that there is a bomb that can destroy a whole city, would it be true just because I don't believe it? I think if you went down into the Ituri rainforest of the old Belgian Congo and found a pygmy, hauled him out of the forest, slapped him up across the head a couple of times and said, hey, listen, sucker, do you know that there's a bomb that can destroy your whole village? He'd probably look at you and say, you know, you got to be suffering from the terminal stupids. But does it make it true because of his ignorance? Is truth decided by ignorance, for crying out loud? When did that begin? Now, this much we all know. That mass and matter has not always existed, and all the people with letters behind their names know that. And any one of them that says that mass and matter has always existed is a damn liar, and he knows better. All right, now that's just for us little guys down here at the bottom. And all you big guys up at the top, you know what I'm telling you is exactly correct. Now, I learned that in the ninth grade, and so did you. So why are you running around here telling us that mass and matter have always existed and that it's eternal? And then they go to the next step and they say, and yes, and the universe that you see out there today is going to slowly over time, it's going to fall back on itself and then it's going to explode again and again and again. This is called the oscillating universe theory. Rimmer goes on to say, we may as well say that literature is the product of chance as to ascribe creation to that source. How many times do you suppose we would have to put the 26 elements of the English language into a hat and then shake them out on a table before they would shape themselves into an evangeline or fall accidentally into the arrangement of a Midsummer Night's Dream? The suggestion is totally preposterous, and chance is ruled out. Well, it's ruled out to anybody that has a brain and isn't brain dead. Who then is this combiner? Who's putting these letters together? Who's putting these elements together? Seeking to evade the only logical conclusion, another man may say, well, recognizing that the universe is a combination of known factors, we believe that law is the combiner. This author would be the last to deny the presence of law in the natural universe. We would point the reader's attention, however, to the fact that law is predicated upon two postulates. There is no law without a legislator, and there's no law without a legislature. The first requisite for law is the presence of a body or a being of sufficient authority to enact the law in the first place. Law, however, remains inactive until there is secondarily a police power, a sufficient authority to enforce the law that has been enacted. A law that cannot be enforced isn't a law. It couldn't even rise to the level of a suggestion without a legislator. Occasionally, we have been in desert places where there is no law. The only guide for conduct was the desire of the individual. Because there was no person, there was no thought of authority. That's called anarchy. And because there was no person or body of authority over that sphere, or none with insufficient reach to enforce the nominal authority, the only law was the ability of the individual to enforce his own paramount desires. If everybody does that, as we see in Baghdad today, we call that anarchy. It might be said that in those regions, the law consists of 6 statutes beyond and bound in one volume by the Colt Manufacturing Company. It's called the six-shooter. The only court of appeal was Judge Winchester, carried in the arm of the appellant. And this condition is possible only where there is no organized body with authority to enact and enforce the law of the land. When a wilderness is too far removed from the governing authority, laws may not be enforced therein. So again, we say that it may not be questioned that there is law in the physical universe, and that such law is implacably enforced. There is a law of gravity. When you break that law, an injury will follow without mercy. The judgments of the cosmos, when its laws are broken, are instant and inescapable. These laws speak with clarion tongue of the great power. Who enacted these laws, and who keeps them in force? And what is this power that we call law? From where does this legal authority come from? Is it derived from the consent of the governed in the universe? Not at all. Natural law is extraneous to the universe that it governs. There's no greater or more logical argument for the existence of dominating intelligence behind creation than the very fact of law that we see around us in nature. Law, however, is a creature and never a creator. Therefore, when we seek for the personality of this combining agency that has wrought this stupendous creation out of 96 elements, mathematically aligned. The term law will not satisfy the truly logical inquirer. Now, some people may seek to find an easy way out by the use of the nebulous term nature. Nature did it. Nature this or nature that, as did the student whose conversation we recorded at the beginning of this chapter. We recognize the existence of the world of nature, and we believe that we can later differ and then offer a definition of the word nature that will meet with the acquiescence of the thoughtful reader. It cannot, however, be advanced that nature is a creator. Nature is itself a postulate. The only truly great scientist who ever sought seriously to define nature begins his definition with the very familiar statement, nature is that blind, unreasoning force that creates without intelligence and thus disqualifies nature as a creator. Can we have creation without intelligence? Yes, I guess we could have creation without intelligence when the parts of an automobile will produce themselves and assemble themselves into a finished and perfect car without the aid or direction of any outside intelligence. We can have creation without intelligence when an airplane will put itself together and fly across the Atlantic with no human help or guidance. Or when a giant bridge, like the Golden Gate Bridge, builds itself across some vast chasm without the aid of engineers and mathematicians. Why will the human mind always seek to evade an issue that does not coincide with its individual prejudices? The clear-cut issue that we face here is the fact of a mathematical problem which is solved by intelligence in the vast realm of the cosmos. If the universe is a combination of these 96 elements and we have the courage to face the issue squarely, we see that intelligence is as much demanded as are the physical factors themselves. It is impossible to postulate intelligence apart from personality. We cannot logically conceive of intelligence as a sort of gas permeating the ether of space. Intelligence not only must be personified, it also must be localized. To meet this issue squarely and to set the matter clearly before the reader, we would suggest this consulting equation. Matter equals creation, and creation equals intelligence. Intelligence equals personality, and personality equals God, which is QED. Let me repeat that. Matter equals creation. Creation equals intelligence. Intelligence equals personality, and personality equals God, which is QED. Now, whether you call this God Allah or Buddha or Yahweh or God or Jesus or Joe Sixpack, somebody who can walk, talk, think, create, produce, do something, did it. Somebody. Now, I've never met this guy. I hope to someday. And I've often said, God doesn't talk to me. And I used to say that until I got an email the other day, and a guy told me that he thought that he was the Messiah. So up until last week, I had never talked to God, but I did get an email from him. Now, boys and girls, there are people out there that sometimes I think are a little off their base. Now, I don't want to get personal with this guy. You know, maybe you are the Messiah. I don't know. I have my doubts, but then, you know, I haven't met him, and so therefore I can't say that you're not him. But I do have a book here that describes him pretty well. So when I see your description, I see your credentials, I'll measure them up against the scripture and see whether or not you match up. Now, nature is itself a postulate. It's something that we dream up. It's something that we think about. Nature is that blind, unreasoning force that creates without intelligence. I hear scientists and I read books and they say, well, nature, that's what we see in nature. We see this in nature. What is nature? Where is nature? Who is nature? Is nature the name of this creating force? Is nature the name of God or Allah or Buddha? If that's the case, then every scientist, every mathematician, all of you evolutionists out there believe in God, a creator, don't you? It's just that instead of calling him Allah, you call him nature. Instead of calling him Buddha, you call him nature. That's your God. Now, there is a God here, and I'm describing the guy that probably most of you hadn't heard much about, the God of the Scripture. Christians don't follow the Scripture. Christians don't get their God out of the Scripture. They get their God out of the local church service or out of the local catechism or out of the local board of elders. This guy in the Scripture identifies himself pretty plainly. For instance, in Genesis 1, 2, and 3, in the creation chapters, he says, you know, I'm God, and I created this, and I did it in 24 hours. Christians don't believe that. Just ask any Christian, do you believe that God created the universe in 24 hours? That'll separate the men from the boys right there. Now, I'm just a reporter. I came here to report to you that that's what he said. That's what he reported. He said he was an eyewitness. He said that he was the guy that did it, and I'm here to report to you that that's the message. If you don't believe the message, I don't care. You're not going to hurt my feelings. I don't get paid for convincing you that I'm right and that you're wrong. I get paid for delivering information. What you do with the information after you get it, it's up to you. Some people use it for one purpose and some people use it for another. That's your choice in life. That's what life's all about, choices. Now, to meet this issue squarely and to set the matter clearly before you, we would suggest this resulting equation. Matter equals creation. Creation equals intelligence. Intelligence equals personality. And personality equals God. That's the QED. Now, that's what we started out to show. Logic demands the existence of an intelligent personified being who we ordinary human beings call God, or Allah, or Buddha, or you evolutionists and smart people call nature. Simply and clearly, men of courage face the issue squarely and confess this fact. Beyond or behind the mathematical perfection of combinations that constitutes the physical universe that we can observe and see, feel, hear, taste, and touch, there is a person that we call deity. So logic demands the very personality that the scripture describes and that the evidences of science attest and testify to. The visible things of creation have ever argued to the logic of thinking creatures the existence of an invisible creator. This conclusion we cannot escape. So the next query must be, does science sustain what logic establishes? And indeed it does. And we believe that this is a statement that is very easy to establish. We deal here with Siamese triplets rather than twins. The three aspects of this matter cannot be divorced. Logic demands, scripture states, and science testifies to the living personality of a creator. Now, when the Apostle Paul addressed the vast concourse of thinkers, these were the intelligentsia of his day on Mars Hill, in the very center of the stronghold of philosophy in his time, he took for his theme this question, can a man find God? And this question, the great apostle answered in the affirmative. He then produced a sevenfold argument from the physical creation to sustain his affirmative answer. And yet in the day of Paul the apostle, men possessed none of the vast scientific knowledge that we have today. The world in which we live teems with myriads of evidences of the existence and the manifestations of a creator, a God, a nature, a deity, who is a person. And if Paul in his day could produce seven known and tested physical facts which demonstrated the existence of God 2,000 years ago, it is not too much for us to say that we can produce 700 today in 1936. Now, this union of science and scripture is really inevitable. And if we grant the existence of an intelligent creator, who then is responsible for the creation of intelligent creatures? It is to be expected that he would seek to make some revelation of himself to that creation, to those creatures. Let me pause right there and give you a mid-course reminder that you're listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide, over the Internet. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals by prearrangement. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, please go to our homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. Our Law Hour website is updated every week. It has our radio log schedule and archives, and that can be accessed through the webpage. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest, and the Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events 7 days a week. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order one for yourself. The number to call, 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief. The Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. However, these endorsements or recommendations that we give out so freely do not mean that those authors or publications that we endorse and recommend are necessarily going to reciprocate. Most of these authors and publications that you hear us cite on the Law Hour are political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans, and their viewpoint is not totally endorsed, in all cases, by the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program, though, are mine and mine alone. They do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of our advertisers, sponsors, the management, or the staff of this network, or of this local radio station. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please go to our website, georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we are reviewing the book, The Harmony of Science and Scripture, in the context of the paid professionals. And so I raised the issue. I said, hey, You honest to God believe these paid professionals over here are as smart as we think they are? I pointed out to you that the President of the United States is a graduate from college, you know, with a degree. And so is Donald Rumsfeld, and so is Vice President Cheney, and so is Wolfowitz and Pearl and all the people that got you involved in this war over in Iraq. And I'm not here to take sides, you know, on the war in Iraq. You know, if you're in favor of the war, that's fine. But hey, listen, we fought more successful wars in the past. You know, World War II came down a whole lot better than this one. And I just wanted to point out that these people that are running this war over here and aren't running the war quite as well as most of the people in the country think it ought to be run is being run by people with letters after their names. Now, it could well be that plumbers, carpenters, and electricians couldn't do a better job. But let me ask you this. Do you think carpenters, plumbers, and electricians could do a poorer job than is being done today? I kind of find that hard to believe. I think that if you had a bunch of dumb carpenters over there, they'd probably end up with the same result that the paid professionals have run into. And that's my point. Just because somebody's got a PhD, he's been to college, and he's got letters after his name, doesn't mean that he knows anything, or that he's got half the skills and abilities that we've been told that he's got, or that he's telling us that he's got. I gotta tell you a quick story here. I had a lawyer one time. His name was Bickle. Hell of a nice guy. Great guy. I always liked old Bickle. And when you went into his office, I'll tell you what impressed me about his office. He had 30 pieces of paper up on his wall. 30. You know, these pieces of paper with little framed, you know, the little frames around them. He had graduated from the University of Illinois Law School. And that was one piece of paper that he had up there on the wall. And over the years, he had developed a number of other pieces of paper that had his name on them and eulogized him and told us what a great guy he was and how smart he was. And I was dumb as a box of rocks. I mean, you know, I couldn't have found the U.S. Supreme Court reports in the law library with a roadmap at high noon with both hands and directions and a guide. I couldn't have found it. But, you know, here's a guy, and I was told that, you know, this guy is real smart and that I wanted to listen to him. And that if I listened to him, that I would make a lot of money and things would go a lot better for me. So I went and hired this guy. He was my lawyer. And I paid him a lot of money. In fact, I paid him $6,000 a year on a retainer. And this $6,000 a year retainer, what that meant was is that I had a telephone on my desk and it had these buttons on here. And Bickle was button number four, I believe it was. And it dialed automatically. See, all I had to do is pick up the telephone and punch four and it would dial Bickle. I hate Bickle, you know. And so then I thought that was pretty heady stuff. I get right in here to the head honcho, and I'd say, hey, I got this contract, I got this deal, I got this or that, something else, and I need you to look at it. Okay, bring it over. And so I'm paying this guy this money. Well, one day I had a problem with a customer, and this case ended up in court, ended up in trial. And so Bickle went in there, and he argued, and he jumped up and down, ranted and raved, pawed the ground, bit the bushes, and did all those things that lawyers do for their clients, and lost the case. It not only cost me $6,000 on retainer, but I had to pay him another $5,000 to do the case. Well, shucks, you know, even the New York Yankees can't win every game. That's the way I figured it. That's the way my friends told me. Well, you know, even Cassius Clay, you know, or Joe Louis, you know, he gets knocked out once in a while. There's a Max Smelling, you know, in the ring every now and again. So time went on some more, paid him another $6,000 for another year. We had another complaint from another customer, and we got into another litigation, and we went through the litigation, had to pay him another $5,000, and old Bickle jumped up, pawed the ground, bit the bushes, jumped up and down, did all those things that lawyers do for their clients, and lost the second one. Well, again, you know, even Joe Louis got knocked out once. I don't remember anybody doing it to him twice, unless it was Rocky Marciano. Maybe he knocked him out the second time. Max Smelling got to him once. I think all Rocky did get him, if I remember right now. Anyway, you know, can't fault a man for being down twice, but, you know, it's disappointing, to say the least, especially for a guy that's got 30 pieces of paper up on the wall. 30. Not one, not two, not six, not nine, 30. 30 pieces of paper on the wall telling us how smart this guy is. I believed these pieces of paper. I believed all the people that told me how smart he was and how good he was and what a great lawyer he was. I mean, you know, he was second only, you know, maybe to William Jennings Bryan, you know, or F. Lee Bailey or Alan Dershowitz, I don't know. But anyway, I kept paying him the money, and we had another complaint, and we had another litigation. And we went to trial again, and old Bickle jumped up, and he represented me, and he pawed the ground, bit the bushes, jumped up and down, ranted and raved, did all those things that lawyers do for their clients, and lost the third time. Now, listen, kids, I'm old, and I was born at night, but I wasn't born last night. Now, that's three in a row. The way I had it figured, now, Bickle was supposed to keep me out of trouble. When he looked over our contracts and our deals, you know, we weren't supposed to have complaints. We weren't supposed to have litigation. Had he done his job correctly, we wouldn't have been in trial to start with. He would have kept us out of trouble. That's the purpose for a lawyer, keep you out of trouble. The real purpose for a doctor is to keep you healthy. Oh, no, not this case. So it cost me $15,000 to argue three cases plus costs. Then it cost me $6,000 a year to hire this guy. And in spite of the 30 pieces of paper, he lost 3 out of 3. So I woke up one day and I said, hell, I can go into court. And I can get up there and jump up and down and rant and rave and paw the ground and bite the bushes and lose free of charge. I don't have to pay some guy $6,000 a year and $5,000 a case to go in there and lose. I can go in there and do that all by myself. And that's when I started. And a surprise of surprises, I went in there, jumped up and down, pawed the ground, bit the bushes, and did all those things that lawyers are supposed to do. I did my very first case, and I won it. Boy, that's pretty heady. Pretty heady for a crummy plumber. That's why I keep telling people, you know, if you want to learn how to do law, you'd be better served to go in there and learn how to do it yourself. You'll get better results. I've discovered over the years that pro se litigants, properly trained, can win about 90% of their cases. And that's a hell of a lot better than licensed lawyers can do. Much, much better. They can only win about 50%. And if they're doing a criminal case, they only win 6% of their criminal cases they win against prosecutors, and about half their cases in civil actions. Pro se litigants win about 90% on both sides. How do you like that? Now, going back here to Harry Rimmer. Harry Rimmer. Well, Harry over here is a scientist. He's a scientist that believes in God and believes in the Bible. Now, I know that most of you people listening out there say, well, boy, that's just one guy in 100. No, it isn't one in 100. No, it's 44 in 100. 44. So when we take a look at scientists and we walk up to them, we say, hey, Mr. Scientist, you, with all the letters after your name, do you believe in God and special creation? 44 of them will answer yes, and 56 of them will answer no. And I'm here to tell you that the 56 that answer no, know better. They know better. I can't tell you why it is that they answer no, but I can tell you that they know the answer to the riddle. They're not stupid. Now, the rest of us out here who are stupid, and I say that kind of tongue-in-cheek, you know, the rest of us out here. I don't want to get in trouble. There was some guy the other day, was it Kerry? He was trying to make a joke about the president over here, stuck his foot in his mouth, I guess. I couldn't believe that anybody would believe that he was deriding or that he was serious about the troops in Iraq being dumb or stupid or in any way. But anyway, somebody made a big flap, you know, over John Kerry. And I know, ain't no lover of John Kerry and that liberal Eastern establishment, you know, but, you know, as dumb as I am, sitting out here in the middle of the heartland over here, I find it hard to believe that John Kerry was making fun of the troops. And I found it even less logical that anybody would believe that he did, but somebody reported that 20% of people actually believed it. I guess you could get people to believe just about anything. But there are some people that believe lies and have a legitimate excuse for it. But scientists and people with letters after their name, they don't have any excuse for not knowing, not understanding that matter and mass have not always existed. They know that. They know that. So if you thought that most scientists over here believe in evolution, there isn't a one of them that believe that that's true, because they all know better. And they ought to be teaching what they believe and what they know, as opposed to lining their pockets. Because, you see, it really is a jobs issue. If you're a college professor, and you're teaching biology, and you walk into your class and you say to these students in here, now, I'm a professor and I've got letters after my name and I'm a paid professional. And I'm here to teach you out of this book, and this book here is spouting off that these animals, that these creatures slowly evolved over time. Now, I know that that's not true, but I have to teach you students that because it's the official policy of the administration of this institution, this university. So I'm going to teach you lies, even though I know better. And any college professor that would say that to his students in his class would lose his tenure. And there are some college professors that have actually come into the classroom and told their students the truth about their discipline. And they have all been summarily fired. Well, at least the three that I heard of. You know, three or four. So college professors are not going to come into the classroom and teach you or tell you the truth. Now, there's another group of paid professionals, and they work for the government, or they work for these colleges and universities. They come to school here every once in a while. And while we're sitting here in class, especially, I had a guy here one time, he was a general. And he was not a big general, just a little general, just a one-star general in the Air Force. And he was in class here one time, and we got to chit-chatting and talking. And he was the head of the John Birch Society down in Jacksonville, Florida. Hell of a nice guy. Bright and articulate, intelligent. And he started telling the truth. He was still in the Air Force. And he had some knowledge, you know, pretty common knowledge, and he had some truth. And so he went around telling his colonels and majors and others, you know, this truth about the Air Force and about the lies and the chicanery that was going on. And they gave him early retirement. Now, that's just one. I could sit here and tell you about another 10 or 15, but I'm just going to tell you about that one guy. And then I want to point out that when a scientist comes through this school, he needs to have some specified or specific legal information or knowledge That's the only reason he comes here. I mean, this guy, I got to tell you the story here. I'll tell you one more. I had a laser physicist come in here one time, and he worked at Alamogordo, New Mexico, and he had a clearance, a security clearance higher than the president of the United States. Did you know that? I was absolutely amazed. I thought the president of the United States, being the commander in chief, would have the highest security clearance that you could get, that he could walk in any place and pick up nuclear bomb secrets or whatever. No. That's not the way the game's played. It's not the way it works. See, the president of the United States might be a communist. He can't know the secret. So that's held by just those people that have a need to know. And I was fascinated by this, and I said, well, wait a minute. You've got a high security clearance? He said, yeah. I said, down there at Alamogordo, can you get into Hangar 54? He said, yeah. Can you get into Area 51? He said, yeah. I said, can the president of the United States get into Area 51? He said, no. How about Hangar 54? He said, no. I said, I'm dumbfounded. How can that be? He said, the president doesn't have any need to know. I said, how about Congress? How about these? No, he said, those congressmen and senators, they're less trustworthy than the president. They can't get into any of these places. I said, wow, that's really interesting. Now, I want you to keep in mind, all these people have letters after their names. They're all paid professionals. And I hear this guy was here about 1990, so it's been quite a few years ago now, but he was a laser physicist down at Alamogordo, and he was making $80,000 a year. He got into trouble because he'd bought a house or two. I forget now if it was one or two houses. He had one house. I'm pretty sure he bought another house, and he was going to fix it up or something. Anyway, he got in over his head, and he couldn't make payments. You know, this was in that last housing downturn, you know, 89, 90, 91, 92, long in there. And he got into financial trouble, and it was a real problem to him because, see, if you've got a security clearance and you go through bankruptcy, or you file for bankruptcy, you lose your security clearance. And that's this guy's meal ticket. He's going to lose his job if he files for bankruptcy. So he needed to solve this problem. So he needed a little specialized guidance. He came down here and went to business school. And here's the thing that really caught my eyeball. This guy didn't come alone. He came with his bodyguard. And he was in a motorhome. Well, I didn't think the motorhome was so strange, but having a bodyguard I thought was really bizarre. And so this is about 1990. Now, down here in Ozark County, Missouri, you know, you don't have a very, very good cell tower. You know, and this guy had a satellite telephone. Now, back in 1990, that was something really new. This was cutting edge technology, you know, back at that time. And every 4 hours, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, this guy has to call in. And why is that? He calls in to his handlers. This is an American citizen. This is an American scientist. This is a laser physicist. I said, how many laser physicists are there? And he said, about 30. 30 laser physicists in the world. And he said, yeah, they're kind of concerned that I might get kidnapped. And so they're always watching me. So I don't go anywhere unescorted. Hell, he's like the president of the United States. He's got a guard with him all the time. Calls in every 4 hours, 24 hours a day. Yep, everything's fine here. We're okay. And he only makes $80,000 a year. But he's got a clearance higher than the president of the United States. This guy's a scientist. And let me tell you, he spouts the official government line. We had a little conversation over here at Amex's restaurant, and we're chit-chatting a little bit. And he said, you know, the truth of the matter is, he said, I know there is a God. I know that the world, the universe, did not happen by chance, and that there has been no past eternity of matter. But he said, I would lose my job if I were to go out and espouse that or let it be known to my superiors that I actually believe that. I got that, boys and girls. This is a guy that's so high up on the scale of science that there's only 30 of his discipline in the whole world in 1990, 30 laser physicists in the whole damn world. And he said, I know there's a God, but he said, I would not tell anybody that, especially my superiors. I'd lose my job. So the 56%, children, of scientists with letters after their names, they may profess that there is no God. They may say that I believe in the Big Bang, but they all know better, every one of them. So they're teaching that crap to you and I down here at the bottom. Now, you and I, we don't know. You know, we go to church, and the preacher over here, he falls right into lockstep with the evolutionists and the scientists that are professing this crap, because they get that from the politicians. It's the official policy. They get it from the educators, who gets it from the Committee of 300. That's what we're supposed to believe, and by golly, that's what they're teaching us. Now, Harry Rimmer comes back, and he says, this the Creator indeed has done. There is a twofold revelation of God spread out in majestic array before every inquirer of our generation. The first and the simplest of those revelations is in the realm that men call nature. Nature is really the compilation of the facts of the physical universe that science has made. The visible works of God are seen, they're studied, they're analyzed, they're correlated, and the resultant body of knowledge is called nature. It is in this arrangement of established facts that the presence of God is most clearly seen. Every realm of pure science ultimately leads you back to the fact of God and of his existence, and it ushers the careful inquirer into his presence. Now, we remember an experience that occurred a good many years ago in the classroom in college. when we were listening more or less attentively in the day's study in a class in biology. It had been our fortunate experience to spend the days of our youth in the mountains, where we lived close to what men call nature. Of books we had very few, but the creatures of botany and all the vast world of zoology were our rather intimate and daily companions. Therefore, we had some difficulty on occasion in accepting the things that were written in the textbooks. Well, in this class in biology, I remember the professor was lecturing that day on his favorite subject. And whenever this good gentleman lacked an explanation of some mystery in the realm of biology, he fell back upon the good old word instinct. Instinct. And on this occasion, as he was describing some fascinating fact of biological importance, one of the students asked him for the basic explanation, and automatically the good professor said instinct. Upon which another student asked, "Doctor, well, what is instinct?" And the professor said, "Instinct is inherited memory. Instinct is inherited memory." Now, unfortunately, we were present in the class only in a physical sense. Most of my mind was out where the fishing was better. But with half an ear, we heard the answer, and without conscious thought, I audibly said, "Uh-huh." This good doctor truly loved a good argument, especially in the class, in front of all of the rest of the students, and always encouraged such. So with vast glee, he pounced upon this unwise rejoinder, leveling a finger in my direction, and he said, "What do you mean? Uh-huh." So not wishing to become the center of attraction, I said, "Well, excuse me, doctor, I wasn't thinking." And with great delight, the doctor nodded and he said, "Not a uncommon phenomenon in this class. Nevertheless, when I said that instinct is inherited memory, you spoke up in the negative. Now, sir, can you defend your position? Can you defend your position?" And right there, I'm going to draw my arrow, boys and girls, and leave you until the next episode in this chapter, and we will take a look at instinct. This is what evolutionists are telling us. This is what the guys with the PhDs are spouting off about. It's inherited memory called instinct. Now let's take a look at the logic behind inherited memory and instinct next time on the Law Hour and Editorial Review. And let me remind you that you've been listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide, over the Internet. If you'd like more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, then please go to our website, georgegordon.org. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. If you'd like more information, please go to the homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. And the Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has a radio log schedule and archives, and it can be accessed through the website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Hey, we're out of time. We've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing, of course. Until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.